are back with episode 649 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and who knew living with Doctor Who was so difficult?
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and some shows are ending up right where we expected them to.
That's right, and I just want to say, do not send in the clones. Just don't. Just please don't. Anyway, we are going to be moving into our episodic discussion for the week ending the 12th of January, 2016. And before we do any of that, Edmund, you actually get to give a disclaimer this time.
Yes. While you might have wished that we hadn't spoiled you with some of the news from last time, I just have to tell you that we will talk about whatever we feel like once again, which means if you haven't seen the episodes we're about to discuss, you will definitely be spoiled.
Mm-hmm. It's a relatively short list this week, only about 8 episodes, so we're only going to have a top 2 and bottom 2, as we usually do when there's a relatively small list. And so we're going to start off with the bottom episodes, and we have a couple that are average or well below. Well below. All right, so we'll start with the one that was average first, and it's one that only I was watching, so that is the Shannara Chronicles, Season 1, Episode 3, Fury. Let's see if I can actually say these names. Will and Amberly are kidnapped by Eretria and Cephalo, and Will must learn how to use the elf stones before a bloodthirsty fury kills them all. For having these names that I can't pronounce.
You did pretty good.
Yeah, I did all right. So I guess what I can say about this one is that at least it was an improvement on the premiere. A relatively small improvement from my point of view. But I feel like this is one of those shows that, again, it's going to take a little bit of time for the writing and the cast to get up to snuff. And it is a bigger production than I think this particular channel has ever tried before. I think what helped this one is that some of the older actors were allowed to do a little bit more this time around. And it got the plot moving a little bit. But I can still say for certain that there are a lot of people that I know who are fans of the books and know the elf stones of Shannara like the back of their hand, and they are semi-furious about this particular adaptation. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I do know that my daughter likes this, and she's a teenager, so that probably is the target audience. There you are. But that is not by any means the lowest show on the list this week. That one belongs to a whole different show. And Edmund, I'm going to let you take this one.
Certainly. That would be Heroes Reborn, Season 5, Episode 11, Send in the Clones. Luke and Melina unite to rescue Tommy and save mankind in the wake of Noah's vanishing. Meanwhile, at the mysterious Sunstone Manor, a battle rages to free prisoners under Matt Parkman's control, and Tommy and Miko team up against Erica.
Mm-hmm. And this one came in at an average of 5.75. Yes, Heroes Reborn is not doing particularly well, at least critically. And that would also be reflected in the ratings and the fact that the show has been canceled. Yes, I think if I go ahead and I look at our season to date, which, by the way, has by far the most shows ever we've had on this list. Heroes is way down at the bottom. And there are a couple shows down here that are faring better, and we've stopped watching them. Because they were doing so poorly. So yes, Heroes Reborn is falling like a big flat dud, despite the fact that it actually has better review scores than Season 4 did. Or Season 3, for that matter. What can you say?
Yeah, but I think the main problem has been we were giving it benefit of the doubt for some interesting ideas at the beginning, and the way it's playing out is just been feeling very tired, very much just sort of going through a checklist as we're jumping around in time and space, but without the benefit of Hero. Some of the characters they brought in as replacements are just not that compelling. I think what actually dropped my score just below John's was in a series that's about superheroes, when we wound up with not one, not two, but three groups of people driving along the interstate towards Odessa. And there was just something about that image that just seemed to me to exemplify, like, no, you guys just really aren't doing a good job at making this compelling at all.
Yeah, they're not. It didn't help at all that they stopped at episode 10 when there were three more to go, rather than just let them run out through the rest of the year, because what were they thinking? That it was going to rebound?
Yeah.
I don't know. But anyhow. So those are the bottom two this week. And that is a vast, vast contrast to the top two, up near the well above the above average mark. And we're going to start with one here that is finally kind of cracking into the top, and that is The Man in the High Castle, Season 1, Episode 8, End of the World. Juliana and Frank plot to leave the Pacific States, but Joe puts them in jeopardy when he tries to obtain a new film. Meanwhile, a shocking family discovery tests Smith's loyalty. Ooh, yes, indeed. Yeah. And this one came in at an average of 8.5. Edmund, what would you say about this one?
Well, with this one, what was going on over on the West Coast, I was rather pleased that the sort of love quadrilateral they seem to have been introducing in the previous episode, with when we learned of Joe's wife and child, just on top of his involvement with Juliana and sort of being in the rival to Frank, that we have sort of moved away from that, because it just seemed to be overly complicating those relationships for no good reason that I could see. Joe actually in this version compared to the book is actually vastly different in terms of being much more ambiguous in his loyalties and giving you much more of a sense uncertainty about which way he's going to go, which certainly works much better for a longer TV series than the way it plays out in the book. Certainly the way all of that played out with in the brothel and the tension involved of with the cops coming in and them getting whisked away at the end by a group that presumably is not connected to the police, I thought was rather well done. And then back on the East Coast, Smith's dilemma just really highlighting rather well, if rather brutally, some of the implications of adopting Nazi and Aryan sensibilities as far as genetics and family fitness, etc., some quite chilling stuff. As I can see that as loyal as Smith has been portrayed up to this point, this is certainly the test for him of whether in fact his genetically compromised son, in fact, should be put down as their ethics decree, or if it's finally going to cause him to maybe question some things. I thought just expansion of the from the themes of the book, good tense storytelling in terms of the main part of the plot and this whole second film. I mean, there's still part of me that does kind of wonder about this whole thing of making it a film that everybody's trying to find rather than a book, because especially since they are in the 60s and you don't have a wide distribution of video, etc. It has been a little hard for me to see this as quite as subversive as the illicit book was in the original novel, but that aside, it certainly has been I think this is a remarkably well done series and a very interesting adaptation in terms of what they're taking from the book and what they're shifting to make it work better for TV or streaming or whatever we're calling these new series, since I actually quite agree with some of these critics who are talking about we need a new category, because the way these series are constructed and get consumed is so different from network or even premium cable viewing. But certainly has been a very good addition to Amazon's lineup, and now if they can just get to more people to watch it.
Well, I mean, they apparently are doing fairly well with that, because they've renewed it for a second season, so that's at least something. You did answer the question that I was going to ask, which was whether or not that particular subplot for Smith was in the book or not, because it really seemed to come out of I wouldn't say it came out of nowhere, but it was a welcome addition to whatever was going on, because it really threw the society into stark relief, because here we have someone that high up and he really isn't going to be able to do anything about it. Usually you've got some degree of corruption that high up, that where the rules don't apply, but No, that was a really stunning turn of events as far as I was concerned, and especially as there are some plot threads that are coming to a point, as we only have two episodes after this for the first season. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Smith and his dilemma here. Will his loyalty be shifting? I don't know.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, when you were bringing that up, I think that there is actually some elements from the book that they haven't really introduced yet that they could. But because one major element in the book is the fact that Hitler is, of course, still alive, but he is dying, and so there is all sorts of political machinations hinted at back in Germany in terms of who is going to take over, and you know. Which faction and the different factions do adhere to different parts of the Nazi philosophy. So there is the possibility of introducing a little bit more ambiguity into what seems like a fairly monolithic society.
Mm-hmm. All right, and that brings us then to our number one show for the week, and once again, this one is hitting the highest marks. It is Jessica Jones, Season 1, Episode 8, a.k.a. WWJD. What would Jessica do, of course? Jessica gets a strange homecoming, courtesy of Kilgrave and Hogarth's conflict with his wife, reaches a tipping point. Oh, yes, a strange homecoming indeed. And this episode came in at a 9.13, this very uncomfortable episode, incredibly so. Yeah, what I can say about this one right off the bat is, while I did give it a little bit of a lower score, it doesn't really make much of a difference when it comes to this series. I was a little put off by the fact that they actually managed to give Kilgrave even a slight sliver of sympathy at this point, because that's just wrong. I don't want to sympathize with him at all. I want him to suffer horribly before the end of this. And yet, you really got this weird kind of understanding of his mindset in the fact that he really does believe that he and Jessica are destined to be together. And just the fact that he's got so much going on under that brain pan of his. He's creepy. He's disturbing on so many levels. He doesn't at all acknowledge the fact that he basically raped her. And she puts it right to him that that's what it was. And he refuses to see it because he wants to believe that Jessica is the one that would be with him regardless of his influence over her. And just the fact that he goes to such lengths as he does in this episode to try to convince her of this point. And even she then brilliantly uses that against him. I mean, that is probably one of the best parts of the episode. But it's just so disturbing and uncomfortable. And so it just continues this brilliant exploration of trauma that this series is kind of well known for at this point. Edmund, what would you add to that?
Yeah, well, certainly, yes. Yeah, so there was that little sliver of sympathy, is I guess the way I would view it. But I think it was more than offset by even though he was not he was very, very deliberately not controlling Jessica, but the way he's controlling everyone else in that situation. I think in particular when she's gone off and he has the chef and the housekeeper keeping an eye out for her, but unable to blink, so that they absolutely do not miss her. And I thought the two actors portraying that did a brilliant job of showing just how horrific that had been for them during all those hours that they were standing at that window. So yeah, I mean, even though they were giving the character perhaps a little more depth, yeah, I don't think it necessarily took that much away from the horror that he projects onto all around him, basically. And certainly that whole sequence of Jessica directly confronting him about the rape was extraordinary, both in terms of her being so direct about it, which was great, but also just the complete non-comprehension on his part, just making that character just as I think still as loathsome as ever, if not more so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really don't know how else to put it than that. It's certainly it's a role that David Tennant, I think a lot of people didn't know if he'd be able to pull it off, but just the fact that there are so many people who say that they will never be able to see him again there are the people who say that now Doctor Who is ruined for them. Too bad. It's definitely a performance that should be at the top of his, or near the top of his resume anyway. This is pretty powerful stuff. But that's all I have to say about Jessica Jones this week, which means that we have a few other shows on the list that we should probably get into. This first one is just kind of, once again, The Good Wife has come back, Season 7, Episode 11, Iowa. Tensions run high as the entire Florek family is crammed into Peter's campaign bus with Eli and Ruth on their way to the Iowa caucuses. Once there, Peter attempts a high-risk political stunt to gain votes for his presidential bid, and Nadim gave this one an 8.5. But probably of more interest to us and many of our listeners is The Expanse, Season 1, Episode 6, Rock Bottom. Miller comes across revealing information on a hidden data cube. At the same time, Holden and the crew are surprised by their host's secret agenda. And this episode came in at an 8.17, which I believe is the lowest that we've had as a score for The Expanse to date. And Gary, you gave it probably your lowest score for this show so far.
Yeah, it was. I want to say I was a little disappointed. I've been really loving this show, and this wasn't that this was a bad episode. It's just that it seemed like it stalled, almost like they're trying to, you know, change direction and go a slightly different way. So I guess that's sort of what it is. We had this whole the crew arriving at that at the Mormon building station.
At Tycho, where they're building the ship for the Mormons. Yes.
Well, from the size of that ship, it looks bigger than the station. So at least from where they docked up. Anyway, so then we're starting to see all these machinations go on, and I guess it's the politics of the situation. The crew wants people want the crew to be held over so that they can try and defuse the situation that's going on between Mars and the Belters, as well as the Earthers. And meanwhile, the former crew of the Canterbury wants to go do this task that they're assigned to. And I didn't understand why they needed to go try and find this person. It never seemed all that clear to me. If they were worried about them taking the ship and them being stuck, they didn't really actually, I didn't feel like they actually said it. So yeah, that whole purpose was unclear. And then we had the detective back at the belt getting, I guess you'd say interrogated, but it seemed like the guy knew most of the answers anyway. He didn't really have to say much, and then almost getting spaced before he was saved by his friend. And then we find out that the corruption goes a little bit further. But again, it seems just so much setup that I just didn't feel like much moved forward. But maybe they needed a pause after the what they had been doing so far. But it just seemed like everybody sort of step back and stopped for a minute in this one.
How about you, Edmund?
Yeah, I think I can see where you could think that about this episode. What I actually liked about it was that even though they were stepping back a bit, it was certainly in the case of Holden and the rest of the survivors of the Canterbury. I thought it did a pretty good job of showing how they were pulling together as a group. There was that sort of sense earlier on, and certainly with during their detention on the Doniger, where the Martian crew was trying to sort of say, highlight their differences and turn them against each other, and this was then showing them pulling together and deciding that they'd rather rely on each other than throw in with Fred or Tycho and or the OPA and some of these other factions, and that it'd be better to just rely on themselves. And certainly when the mission goes off and it is that crew, I thought that was it wasn't necessarily helping to move the story forward, but it was helping to move the characters forward and establish them as more of a cohesive unit in the face of all of this uncertainty and other stuff going on around them. For me, I've said it before, I do just enjoy Thomas Jane and the way he's playing up the whole sort of anachronistic hard-boiled detective in this futuristic setting. So even though some of it was a little cliched and as you say, not quite an interrogation, it was more of an intimidation that was going on. I'm still just enjoying that storyline, and there are certain times. I mean, when his hard drinking getting a bit obsessed by Juliet Malway's. He feels like a distant outer planet cousin of Charlie Jade to me sometimes.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, you know, I do feel like this was a little bit of a slower episode, but at the same time, I still feel like the excellence of the show is still shining through. So for a lot of the reasons that have been brought up, and there are some episodes that I think where the plot lines are kind of more in transition, and maybe that's this was one of those episodes. But I feel like it's kind of earned a lot of benefit of the doubt as far as I'm concerned. So there we are. Let's see here. Next on the list is iZombie, Season 2, Episode 10, Method Head. Liv is crushed when she discovers that the lead actor on her favorite show, Zombie High, has been murdered on set. Meanwhile, Vaughn tests Major's loyalty. Ravi delivers some bad news, and Blaine receives an unexpected visitor. And this one came in at an average of 8. And Edmund, we both gave this one 8, so there we are.
Yep, and I thought this it was iZombie. Of course, had also taken a little bit of a holiday break, it was one of those cases when they came back, and with all of the Christmas themed stuff at the beginning, I was kind of wondering. It's like, oh, wait a minute, were the producers expecting this to air before Christmas, perhaps, but not weeks afterwards? But that didn't really detract, since there was really more just the intro, and then certainly got into a lot of very 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 fun meta stuff when we finally got onto the set of Zombie High, and Liv gets to literally act out some of her fantasies from this show that she has quite understandable reasons has gotten so obsessed with, coming from the producer of Veronica Mars, and having a strong background in fandoms and how obsessed they can be. I thought this was a very very fun episode. I will say the one thing that the continuing major storyline was one. This was one case of the test was a little too obvious, but certainly no surprise when it wound up the way it did. Perhaps the part of the episode that and kind of that plot line in general, I've really been wondering where they're going to go with that, because it just seems to be sort of slightly painted into a corner at the moment, we are just waiting for Major to finally come to his senses and help take down the whole Max Rager part of things, but for now we're kind of treading water with that part of the story.
Yeah, I'm with you with thinking that maybe there was some kind of weird rearrangement of episodes, or if not that, then at least it was supposed to air before Christmas, and for some reason it didn't, because, it was like, why are we having a Christmas episode in the middle of January? But other than that, I feel like this was fun as far as Liv and her obsession with the show, like you said. But I still agree, too, that we barely got up to the 8, in my opinion. It kind of was by proxy of that little subplot, and the fact that clearly Liv was having a ball, and even some of the other characters being on set, they were having so much fun that kind of was infectious. But some of the plot lines are taking their time in the background, and I feel like that's why some of the episodes before this were coming in a little lower. So the second season not quite hitting the same marks as the first season. And in fact, if I go ahead and look, it's a little lower. So hoping that iZombie can kind of pick it up, although they did get more episodes, so I guess it's doing well enough, right? Let's see. And finally, that brings us to the final episode for the week. And Gary, why don't you take this one, since I have a lot to say.
Yeah, no problem. So we're talking about Elementary, Season 4, Episode 7, Miss Taken. Watson is enraged when her stepfather writes a crime novel based on her work with Holmes and herself, without her knowledge. Meanwhile, Sherlock and Joan investigate a retired FBI agent's murder and learn the man's death is linked to an unsolved case from the victim's career. This came in at a 7.5, and I were pretty for this. I thought the B story of the crime novel was a cute little twist on both Watson and Holmes and the real world. So, and I enjoyed how she both came to terms with that, and how Sherlock could have really cared less. So that was fun. The main plot, as usual with Elementary, had a little bit of a twist to it, but it really it did strike me as some sort of amazing mystery. Did you like which plot did you like better, Edmund, the A plot or the B plot?
This is one case where actually I was kind of amused at how the casting kind of tipped things off a little bit, casting John Hurd as the stepdad, who has basically made a career now out of playing these charming cads. So even though he had done this horrific thing in Joan's eyes, or at least certainly, you know, not doing it behind her back and not asking for any permission, etc., it was no surprise that things kind of came around in the end. But yeah, certainly the contrast of Joan trying to keep it from Sherlock and then discovering that Sherlock actually knew all along and didn't really care, because plenty of people had based works of fiction on himself, something he was kind of used to at this point. But on that A plot, I know it wasn't a show you had been watching, Gary, but casting Tilda from Into the Badlands in that role kind of tipped me off from the beginning that this girl might not be all that she appears to be, has certainly turned out to be the case. And my biggest disappointment was more that right at the very end there, where she has her little sparring session with Sherlock in the cell after she's been caught. It to me kind of brought up that wait a minute, you've got an interesting character here who maybe they are setting up for more things down the road, but it would have been nice to see a little bit more of that sparring going on throughout the episode, because they just kind of set it up and then just left it hanging. After we were talking about the previous episode with Moreland being set up as more of a traditional big bad, the way they'd done in their earlier seasons, I was then wondering if, and kind of hoping, on the strength of that final scene, that she's going to be returning as well, perhaps in some capacity, because I thought the way they presented her and the chemistry between her and Sherlock holds some promise, but we will have to see if the producers and writers actually have something more interesting for her to do down the line.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, that's it for Elementary then, unless, Gary, you had more to say on that one.
No, I think we've hit most of the points.
All right, and that means that I think what we're going to do is go ahead and close out this episode a little bit short, but that's okay. And when we come back next time, we've got some feedback that we'll go through, and then any open topics that we have for the week. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.